really the only thing left to negotiate is the wages. And even that, I don't know what's left to negotiate, honestly.
Union leaders react to Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan's proposal that guts bargaining power. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 11th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Alan Moore wins his first Yukon Quest after narrowly losing last year.
You can stay motivated after losing by 26 seconds, so that's the good thing about it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Meridian Management, specializing in coordination and management of all phases of construction projects from vision to completion, working to ensure that your project is on time and on budget. More at meridianak.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD, or paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Medically necessary abortions would be defined as those needed to avoid serious risk to the life of the woman under a bill introduced in the Alaska Senate. The measure from Senate Majority Leader John Coghill says the state health department may not pay for abortion services unless they are medically necessary or the pregnancy was the result of rape or incest and the rape or incest was promptly reported to law enforcement or public health authorities. The Alaska Supreme Court has held that the state must fund medically necessary abortions if it funds other procedures deemed medically necessary for people in need. A legislative legal opinion last year, however, said it's not clear what makes an abortion medically necessary and that it's likely only further litigation will provide greater clarity. Democratic legislators have rolled out their oil tax proposal, and the bill is more of a modification of the current tax structure than an overhaul. It would cap the windfall profits tax at 30% and create credits for heavy oil research and development and the construction of new processing facilities on the North Slope. It would also exempt 20% of oil from new fields from taxes for the first 7 years in production. The bill has been pitched as an alternative to Governor Sean Parnell's plan to lower taxes on oil companies. Parnell's bill would get rid of a mechanism that raises taxes on oil companies as the price per barrel goes up, and it gets rid of some exploration credits in favor of ones tied to production. The Democrats' bill is now winding its way through the legislature with a handful of hearings in both the House and the Senate this week. Parnell's office is currently reviewing the minority's bill and offered a brief statement saying that the governor is pleased that Democrats, quote, agree there is a problem with production under the current system. About 90% of Alaska's tax revenue comes from oil production. Anchorage workers are speaking out after being told the mayor and assembly are proposing an ordinance to limit the power of unions. Mayor Dan Sullivan is proposing the ordinance along with Assembly Chair Ernie Hall and Vice Chair Jennifer Johnston. The mayor says he's just trying to delivery of the highest value services at the lowest reasonable cost to the citizens of Anchorage, while union leaders say he's taking away workers' rights. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Union leaders say, as it stands now, the proposed ordinance would leave them basically nothing left to negotiate. They say it will impact benefits, pay, and contract negotiations, including eliminating the option of a strike. Rod Harris, president of the Anchorage Firefighters Union, which represents about 400 workers, says he was shocked to find out about the proposal late Friday.
This is over the top. You know, I know the mayor really wants to address wages and benefits, but he has gone to great lengths here to make sure that anything to do with working conditions or anything to do with the employee having a voice in their own safety practices has been removed and made a management right. And he's gone further to say that everything in the city is up for privatization except for anybody that works in a police car or on a fire truck.
Harris was one of many union leaders that met with Mayor Dan Sullivan Monday morning to review the proposed ordinance. It would impact approximately 2,200 municipal employees, from accountants to police officers and firefighters. Union leaders are especially concerned that a quick timeline for the ordinance could limit public input. It's set to be introduced to the Anchorage Assembly at their next regular meeting. Municipal officials say it could be passed before the end of the month. Jason Allward is with Local 301, which represents about 100 workers that plow snow, haul waste to the landfill, and maintain streets, among other things. He attended the Monday morning presentation where the mayor explained the proposed changes, including that wages would be tied to a 5-year average of the Consumer Price Index.
Really, the only thing left to negotiate is the wages, and even that, they have tied that to the 5-year average of the CPI. I don't know what's left to negotiate, honestly.
When asked to characterize the mayor's leadership style, Allward said,
"Well, in this case, it's clearly a dictatorship. This is the way it's going to be, whether you like it or not."
Mayor Dan Sullivan says he's just trying to tighten the purse strings of local government. Cities across the U.S., Sullivan says, are implementing similar changes to create something he calls managed competition.
Oftentimes in managed competition, the employee groups win the bid to perform the service. But when they're put into a competitive environment, it's amazing how they sharpen their pencils and they know their jobs best of all. And they find ways to do it even better and at less cost.
Sullivan says a letter is going out to employees regarding the proposed changes, which he's hoping will be implemented by the Assembly in the next couple of weeks. Assembly Chair Ernie Hall says it could take longer, though.
It's going to take the time that it takes to get the job done. If we're able to do it in that timeline, you know, that's fine, but it's going to take due process.
Hall says negotiations with at least 2 labor organizations are set to begin in March for contracts that expire in June. The new rules would not affect current contracts, only new ones. The proposed ordinance will be introduced to the Assembly on Tuesday, February 12th. A public hearing will be held February 26th, and the proposed ordinance could be passed at that time. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The recently ousted leader of the Alaska Republican Party is fighting his removal. It's just another clash in a long battle between establishment Republicans and members of the Ron Paul and Tea Party movements. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The announcement came on Saturday morning during a meeting of the party's Central Committee in Juneau. Russ Millette, who was elected chair in April, is appealing his dismissal on a technicality. Millette alleges that the committee illegally met to prevent him from becoming chair, and that the group was wrong to have him expelled before he was actually seated.
I'm doing it because I want to see my name cleared, and number two, there are a lot of people that vote for me and a lot of people that didn't that want to see this thing cleared up, and they want justice to prevail. Whether that can happen or not, we're going to see.
Millette was removed from the party's executive committee on January 31st, a day before his term as chair was scheduled to begin. He was elected last spring with support from the Republican Party's Libertarian faction, and for the past 8 months, he's served in the interim role of finance chair, a fundraising position meant to prepare the chair-elect to direct the organization. But the party's rules committee concluded that Millette failed to raise money for the group in that time and, thus, was unfit to lead. At the same meeting, Millette's vice chair also came under the scrutiny of the Rules Committee. They had considered removing Debbie Brown from her post on charges that she had mismanaged funds at a district level. The complaint against her was ultimately dismissed. Instead of losing her position, Brown was promoted to chair. At the gathering of the Central Committee on Saturday, reaction to Millette's removal and appeal was mostly addressed indirectly. It was the first time the group had met since Brown had taken Millette's spot. She laid out her goals as a new leader, explaining that she wanted to bring fresh faces to the party and to see more grassroots activism. She also alluded to the recent turmoil the party had faced at the executive level.
There's a lot of stress focused on one another with inside the group, within our own group, and I feel that's very, very unfortunate and counterproductive to us. It reminds me of terrorism in a way. It's treacherous.
Many in the room took issue with Brown's choice of words and asked her to explain her statement. Brown reiterated that she felt that some within the party had agendas that were, quote, somewhat terroristic in nature, without identifying any members or factions. In a follow-up conversation, Brown said that she wasn't referring to anyone specifically and that she wants to see the party move forward together. She spoke of fostering a kind and respectful dialogue to achieve that. During the meeting, Brown also attempted to replace the existing treasurer and assistant treasurer with her own appointees. Recently, a large portion of the party's funds were transferred to a Juneau Republican group to be protected during what former chair Randy Riedrich described in a January statement as a period of uncertainty and reorganization. Both of the current treasurers are his appointees. Brown was overwhelmingly overruled by the Central Committee as being out of order in her effort to install her own people. After the Central Committee meeting, Riedrich downplayed the divisions within the party. He pointed out that membership is still high and that Republicans exert greater control over state government than they have in years.
For folks to talk about there being a problem, they're not looking at the preponderance of the data.
Millett has a gloomier view on the state of the party.
Just let me say this. The party is killing itself. It just is.
Millett's appeal is scheduled to be heard in Homer on May 25th, at the next gathering of the Central Committee. The party could call an emergency meeting for the appeal with a petition from 25% of the Central Committee members. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what the upper reaches of Denali feel like in the dead of winter.
It's a place that doesn't give off life at all. Life is what you bring to that spot.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Monday, February 18. The councils provide information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. For more information on the advisory councils and how to apply, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
A federal judge has denied a bid to block the Port McKenzie Railroad spur project. U.S. District Court Judge Ralph Beistlein today handed down his decision, saying that extensive environmental studies were conducted over a period of years regarding the project and that the benefits of the project are great, while further delay in construction would not be in the public interest. A number of environmental groups headed by Cook Inlet Keeper had asked for a preliminary injunction halting initial construction of the line linking Port McKenzie and Houston. Oral arguments in the case were heard on February 7th. A research rocket was successfully launched from Poker Flat north of Fairbanks last week. The 67-foot-high, 11,000-pound rocket was launched into the upper atmosphere February 6th. The rocket was sent into the aurora above Alaska's northern coast, deploying sensors that send data back to Earth. The project is aimed at understanding how the aurora heats and energizes the upper atmosphere, creating a stream of oxygen. NASA Space Flight Center's Doug Rowland, the project's principal investigator, says the instrumentation included a special camera that sees atoms.
It'll catch those atoms that are coming. It'll count how many came in. So as we spin around, we can make a picture of the whole sky, see where these oxygen atoms are coming out, and make a map of that, and then compare that to the auroral pictures to say, hey, here's an auroral hotspot, and there's more oxygen coming out there, or sort of watching the oxygen grow over time and then and decay as the energy input grows and decays. So that's kind of the new aspect of this experiment.
Says understanding the stream of oxygen created by the aurora is important because of its effects on Earth-to-space communications and travel.
When we get a major solar storm or a large auroral display, those oxygen ions and atoms that get kicked out modify the Van Allen belts. We care about those because they're of interest to satellite operators, in principle to astronauts, you know, if they were going to be out in that region.
Rowland says the successful 16-minute flight ended with the rocket crashing into the Arctic sea ice north of Alaska. It was this winter's primary scientific launch project at the Poker Flat facility, which is owned by the University of Alaska Fairbanks and contracted to NASA. For the next several weeks, APRN will be airing a series that looks at how Alaskans describe what makes their way of life unique. Whether you live in a village or a city, everyone has a culture, and we're going to bring you stories of how both urban and rural Alaskans define and live theirs. The series is funded by a grant from the Alaska Humanities Forum, Rose Urban Rural Exchange. First up, we start with a common intergenerational complaint. Kids don't go outside anymore. They're too interested in video games or TV or the internet. APRN's Ann Hillman spoke with people in rural and urban Alaska who are trying to limit the impact of technology on young people.
Last fall, I was hanging out in the dorm lounge at Ilisovik College in Barrow, talking to a group of guys in their early 20s, including Joseph Okaguk.
I mean, back then, we didn't have all this technology and all that, too. I mean, you see now kids staying home, playing video games on the internet, texting. Watching TV, texting. We didn't have all that. Yeah. We had the big box screen TVs, so we didn't really want to carry it around. We had barely any video games, so we're all...
Cordless landlines. So,
yeah, dial-up connection. but yeah, we grew up playing outside, going hunting, everything.
Okaguk sounds more like an 80-year-old than a 20-year-old, but his laments are common throughout the North Slope and in Anchorage. One Anchorage family is trying hard to make sure their kids don't get sucked into technology's black hole.
This is how I keep myself busy. I like to play with my brother Milo, and he's 5, and you'll soon get to hear him.
8-year-old Wyatt talks for a while about playing with toys, going to school, and even sleeping. Eventually, his brother chimes in.
We do fun things like go on hikes and go skiing and sometimes watch movies and make art.
Their mother, Valerie Waldrop, explains that her kids aren't allowed to play video games, even at their friends' houses, and they can't play with their father's iPad either.
What about the internet? Like, do they have unrestricted access to explore the internet, or...?
No, they're not even allowed on our computer, so they're pretty delayed on that, too. Oh my gosh, I hope I'm not ruining them.
She wants her boys to play outside and remember how to be creative, so she sets strict rules. She only works part-time and can monitor all of her kids' activities, but she understands why it's hard for parents to set the same standards.
You know, I have a lot of compassion, because I think at some point it just takes such a huge effort to maintain this idea that once you give in a little, it escalates and it's really hard to back up.
In her family, that slippery slope started with watching movies. They used to watch 2 a month. Now it's 1 or 2 every week. But movies and movie characters are hard to avoid. The boys take me on a tour of their toys.
Are those guys stormtroopers?
No, part clone trooper, part stormtrooper, and this is the
and
same.
And the boss, part clone trooper,
this
part
stormtrooper. Protects Anakin Skywalker, this guy. Okay.
They know the details of all the Star Wars movies, even though they've only seen one of them. But Wyatt assures me that they aren't just reenacting the movies.
We're not saying, like, okay, pretend Darth Vader got killed by Luke. No, I'm not pretending that. We're pretending... like some our own things with the guys, though.
The boys are trying to be creative while still being able to relate to other kids their own age. Waldrop says both she and her kids have to perform a balancing act.
For the rest of our parenting lives, we have to learn how to deal with that, not wanting them to be different, wanting them to feel comfortable with their friends, but also wanting to stay true to our values.
She plans on letting her kids play some non-violent video games when they're older, but she's holding off for as long as she can. She hopes our unconventional parenting plan works, but...
Come back in 15 years to see how screwed up they are.
For APRN, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years.
The Kinnick Arm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Alan Moore's 11-dog team pulled the musher across the Yukon Quest finish line early this morning. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the win is fitting after a narrow miss last year.
After crossing the finish line, Alan Moore stepped off his runners, checked in his mandatory gear, and greeted his wife, 2000 Yukon Quest champion Allie Zirkel.
How you doing, baby?
Fantastic.
Woo!
Ready to do it again.
After losing by 26 seconds to Huneff last year, the Two Rivers musher built himself an ultralight sled. The bags made from material used for sails on competitive sailboats. He also trained his dogs repeatedly on the run between the last checkpoint and the finish line.
You know, it was a pretty good motivator. You can stay motivated after losing by 26 seconds. So That's the good thing about it.
Moore and Huneff chased each other for nearly the entire race this year. Moore finally dropped his competition at mile 101, and the two teams didn't see each other again until they took a mandatory 8-hour layover at Two Rivers, the last checkpoint on the trail. Roughly an hour after Moore finished, Huneff drove 9 dogs across the line. It's his 13th Quest finish. In the team was Walter, a 9-year-old sled dog who's finished 6 Yukon Quests and 3 Iditarods.
Oh, yeah, this is Walter's last race. He's getting up there now. He's done 9,000 milers, so. But he's a couch potato, so he's with me every day.
Neff will keep 4 ounces of gold he won after pulling in first at Dawson City, the race's halfway point. It's valued at nearly $7,000. That's in addition to a second-place prize of more than $13,000. Alan Moore's first-place prize is a little more than $18,000. Moore finished in 8 days, 18 hours, and 57 minutes. It's a new fast time, but with a reroute that cost the race a climb over American Summit and slashed 50 miles from the total distance. It'll be recorded in the history books with an asterisk. On the Yukon Quest Trail in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Lonnie Dupree says cold weather is his forte. The mountaineer has spent the last 3 winters trying to become the first person to summit Denali solo in December and January. He's failed all 3 times and encountered harsh storms, temperatures well below zero, and death-defying ice along the way. But the Minnesota explorer says he's still optimistic the climb can be done. He sat down with APRN's Annie Fite to talk about this year's expedition. He says at 17,000 feet, he could feel fluid building up in his lungs and made the choice to turn around.
If you go, you're going to die. Pretty easy to go, well, I don't want to do that, so I think I'll head back down. And so naturally, I mean, it's a learning experience. And so, but it's a lot of the decision making is very cut and dried for you. You know, it really is. It's not, there's a lot of things that you just can't argue with or debate over or things like that. Like having fluid on your lungs is a big no-no, because traveling solo, that's a whole different story. And you're the only one that's able to take care of you. And there's nobody that's going to come up and get you. And there's nobody that's going to come save you or anything like that, because wintertime on Denali, you're limited with light. At extreme cold, there's very few people that are acclimated to come rescue you. So it's a difficult deal. You're pretty much on your own, and you have to take care of yourself. And you don't want to put anybody at risk and to come get you anyways.
How did this trip compare to the other two?
You know, the best trip I had, or in terms of succeeding in terms of getting close to the summiting, was my very first trip in 2011. I got up to 17 quite fast, but the weather was pretty windy above there, and I kept staying there, and I stayed about a week waiting for that weather that never came. And I, on my way down to 14, the weather actually started getting better. And then last year was atrocious. The weather was atrocious all the way through. And I had a long talk with Masatoshi, a Japanese fellow that's trying to solo summit Hunter in the winter, which is right off of base camp there. And this is his 7th try, so I learned patience from Masatoshi. You know, I think he spent 80-some days trying to get up Hunter 1 year and got within 1 day of getting to the summit, but had to turn around. So that guy's got patience.
And so is that patience maybe in your future? Can you see doing this?
Well, I'm going to need, with Denali, you always got to have patience. And I think if I try it again at some point, I just need to be, I need to just be a little more patient. When I get to 14, maybe just, regardless of any small weather windows that come in that look like I may be able to get to the summit, just hold off until we can determine maybe even a longer stretch of more stable weather, maybe 5 days to a week or something, and then go. Because once you go up to 17, there's no coming back to 14 and then going up and trying again. It's just too much work. So 14 is kind of the staging area where you really need to be patient and wait out whatever weather comes and hope for a weather window of 4 or 5 days.
You sound like you're going to do this again, whereas last year when I talked to you at about this time, you were more iffy on the whole prospect.
You know, right after these projects, you get off of these projects soon after, of course, and you remember all those hardships and cold conditions and shivering in your sleeping bag all night or whatever the case may be. But over time, you forget about those things. So, yeah, right now I'm just saying I'm probably not going to come back next year. I'm going to give it maybe a year or two break and then come back with maybe some better knowledge and a little bit more chutzpah.
Well, describe the most magical parts of the trip.
The magical parts of the trip are morning and evening light on the mountain peaks around you. It's really, that time of year, it's really kind of prehistoric, you know, it's rock and ice and then you get that light coming in that is, pinks and lavenders and, reds even. And, that is just, warms the place up. And actually, if you can be lucky and be on a part of the mountain that's actually getting sunlight, you're not stuck in some gorge or valley somewhere that's not getting any light. And then you get up really super high, like up to 17, and it's like being on the moon. 17 is serious because it's hard for you to enjoy your surroundings because it is such a, it's a place that doesn't give off life at all. Life is what you bring to that spot. And there it's all business, you know. You've enjoyed your pleasure on the way up to 17, and now it's business. Now it's about staying alive and doing, making the right choices and reflecting on it when you get back.
Mountaineer Lonnie Dupree talking with APRN's Annie Fite about his latest attempt to summit Denali solo in the depth of winter. A Homer filmmaker is producing a film about Dupree called Cold Love. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Ann Hillman from Anchorage and Barrow. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer, Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Regardless of where you live, you've got a better shot at earning the Alaska Performance Scholarship by enrolling in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. ANSEP challenges students with classes that are necessary to earn the scholarship. ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Monday, February 18. The councils provide information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. For more information on the advisory councils and how to apply, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.